Welcome to Threads of Enlightenment, your journey into personal growth. The splendor of any decision is after you've made it. All that remains to be seen are its consequences. My name is Ken Primus. I am your host. Here at Threads of Enlightenment, we talk about the principles of self-development and personal growth. By having conversation with people who have walked through their journey of personal growth. We believe that everyone at some point in their life will have to deal with one or more of these principles to have the privilege of focusing on their self-development as humans. These principles, when applied, can help you to become the best self possible. Welcome to Threads of Enlightenment, and thank you so much for coming, Kim. It is my pleasure to have you here at our show. I love to have guests come and tell us about what they have created today, because it is my belief that we are all creators. And then what we do is go in and take and dissect all of that information that you have given to us and get to know you at a level that is deeper than that introduction. Welcome, and thank you for coming to Threads of Enlightenment.
Ken, I am thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation. I appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. Actually, it was funny when I saw you, when you sent your invitation, I looked at your stuff right away. I'm like, I got to get in touch with her right away so that you can come and bless us with your presence. So tell us about where you are today, what you have created in your world today.
Sure. Yeah. I am a mother and a grandmother. I have 5 kids. I have 11 grandchildren. And I'm married for almost 29 years to a wonderful, wonderful man before he passed away. I'm an entrepreneur. I started my first business right out of high school. I run a nonprofit organization. I'm an author. I have 2 books. Cry Until You Laugh is my first book. And then most recently, Love is a book that was just released about a month and a half ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Grandkids and mom of 5. 5. Tell me the makeup of the family. Boys and girls. How is it?
Yeah. 4 boys and 1 girl. And let me tell you, the 1 girl was as much work as all 4 boys put together. So the boys were me.
I totally understand. I am a single dad of 5 boys. And so people look at me and go, how did you do it? And to me, it was the easiest thing ever. But people could not understand the dynamics of having a relationship with 5 boys. But I could not imagine a girl. I don't think I would be able to handle it.
Yeah, most of the time I couldn't handle it either. So, yeah.
So I have 5 granddaughters and I can't handle it.
At least they're different when they're grandkids than when they're, they're your children. Yeah.
So you're an author. I want to go back into your formative years. I believe that our formative years began when we were young with our families. Our mom and dad are imperfect beings, and they taught us what revelations they knew, how they knew it. We were brought up also by systems, educational systems, the church systems, all these organizations outside that helped to create you. Talk to me about some of that input of information and what type of person were you?
Sure. Yeah. So I was in the perfect spot. Like, if you could choose where to be in a family, I was in the perfect spot because I was the only girl. I'm the only girl and the youngest. And there's just not a better spot in the family to be. I have 2 older brothers, and we were born 12 months apart. So we're right in a row. So we did everything right in a row. Started school right in a row, graduated right in a row. You know, just kind of everything. I come from a very competitive family. We were, mm-hmm. into sports, into everything that we could do, joined every club, you know, in every musical, in everything that you could be in, very active. I grew up in the Catholic Church. I was raised Catholic, and appreciate that now more than I did before. I have to say, appreciate the sacredness of Mass and some of the beauty that is the Catholic faith. I was going to be the first woman president. That was my goal. And so I had my life laid out in front of me. I knew exactly what I was going to do. And one thing I was not going to do was get married and have kids. But then at the end of my senior year of high school, this beautiful man entered my life. And he was 4 years older than I am. And 10 days after I met him, I asked him if he would marry me. And he said, yes. We got married a little bit less than a year later. And kind of against all odds, had a great marriage. When I met him, he'd been going to these prayer meetings. He was raised Catholic as well, but had been going to these charismatic Catholic prayer meetings. And so I started going to those with him. And they were amazing. I mean, just feeling the Spirit was just amazing. And so we ended up going to an Assembly of God church. Then we went I went to a non-denominational church after my husband passed away. And then now the world is my church. I went through some traumatic things for sure along the way. My mom committed suicide. Wow. That was a tough moment, probably the hardest thing I've ever been through in my life. I was in my 20s. My kids were little and not anything I ever wish on anybody. I learned a lot about suicide. I learned to come to grips with it. It was something I couldn't really wrap my head around for the longest time. And I think it's very misunderstood. I think that people look at suicide and immediately think of selfishness. Like, how could they do that to me? How could they do that? Well, first of all, they didn't do it to you, right? But also, when you are in that dark of a spot, when you're... Because I don't go there. I don't think about suicide. But when somebody is in that dark of a place and that they're thinking about ending their life, quite often what's going through their mind is they'd be better off without me. Like if they're not here, that everybody else can go on with their lives, that they're a burden on their families. And I believe with my mom, I think that's what was going through her mind. She was an alcoholic. And things just were not going great in life for her. And she'd been through a series of not terrific things. She survived a hurricane that went right over St. Croix and the Virgin Islands and had surgery kind of all at the same time. And then just sort of the perfect storm happened to her. And But, you know, the beauty of it, though, Ken, is that I would never wish it on anybody. But because I've been through that in my life, I can relate to people who've been through that in their life. And I have been called many times when somebody has a friend who has somebody in their family or somebody they love die that way. I get a phone call and I'm at their house and talking to them and helping them with whatever support I can possibly give them. And if I wouldn't have gone through that, I wouldn't have that opportunity. And so I think that, you know, the things that we go through, we have a choice. We can either use the things that we have gone through, make positive come from bad stuff, or we can wallow in it. We can just stay behind and not grow and mature beyond.
Yeah, it's you have a powerful story. What hurts me, because I've had situations like that when people say that they're selfish, I think the person who made that comment is selfish, because you have to be able to put yourself in that person's space, the empathy, the darkness for them to make that final decision, the pain, all of the other things. I think we need to take the time to reflect more on their story, not our story. And so a selfish person will say they did that because of selfishness, because the pain that person is in. And I believe the fact that you have gone through that and allows you to be able to reach to people that are going through that. Why? Because I believe, as you were saying, you guys were in prayer and so forth. Once you're in there, the faith that you have when you're speaking to someone carries a tremendous amount of power, because why? You have lived it. You have been a part of it. And so it's not, you're not speaking just from what you read in a book or whatever. You're speaking from an experience that you have gone through and that you found your way through. And when you carry that message to someone, it will have this impactful force within that delivery as you deliver it to them, that it will change their life. And so you went through that in order to be effective this way. And I tell people the reason why God can trust some of us, that when we come out of it, we can then reach back to people. He needs people that are not selfish, where they stay within the mess, but the ones that are, have guts and courage to come out, because he wants to use them as servants. That's the end results of all of this thing, that once you go through that path of what I call enlightenment, is for you to become a servant. And what a beautiful space that people can call on you, and you have that effect on that family member or that person whenever they call on you. It's a privilege, Kim, to be there.
Yeah, it is. It is a privilege for sure. I mean, it's such a shocking thing. I think it's the worst way to lose somebody. Because, you know, accidents happen and illnesses happen. Yeah. And those are not that that's ever good or happy. Yeah, you know, yeah. That's tough too. But yeah. But I agree. I had a couple of my kids had seizures growing up. And that's another thing, you know, when parents are faced with illnesses with their kids, it either breaks up couples or brings them closer together. Like there's so many things that we get to choose in life, right? There's some things that we don't get to choose. Like I didn't choose my mom dying that way. I wouldn't have chosen that. I didn't choose my kids to have seizures. You know, I wouldn't have chosen that. I wouldn't have chosen losing my husband when I was 47 years old. You know, those are choices that were beyond my control. But the things I can control are what I do with it, how I move forward. If I use it in a positive way, if I choose to live a joyful life and a life of love and peace and wonderment. And that is what I choose to do for sure.
That's powerful stuff that you've talked about. One of the principles, I believe the key principles in personal growth, is the power of the decision. You and I, when we are not on that journey, I believe we just kind of drift. And we think we're making decisions, but we are reacting to circumstances. But when you are starting in your journey, you are making decision, because when you make a decision, it is a powerful tool that allows you to manifest things in your life. I want to talk to you, pan back a little, Kim, because you were telling the story of your mom. I want to go in there a little deeper as to how did that process, that time, affect Kim, the individual, as to how you made decisions, how did you govern your thinking process within that dark space?
It was there was a cloud. When I got the phone call, my brother called me. And at the time, I was homeschooling my kids because of their seizures and the medication that they were on. They couldn't stay mm-hmm. awake all day in school. They needed to nap in the afternoon. And so my brother called and told me that my mom had died. And I talked to her every day. We were really close. And told me how. And I just was in disbelief. And my first reaction was went back to my Catholic roots. And in Catholicism, you're told that if you commit suicide, you go to hell. And hell's a whole nother conversation, right? But yeah, you're told, you know, that's what the Catholic Church teaches. And so immediately my mind went backward a bunch of years to my Catholic upbringing. And and so I was panicked for a lot of different reasons. And I went to the next door neighbor's house. I called my in-laws to come and watch the kids. My next door neighbors came over to watch them so that I could leave right then. And all the way driving there, I was just crying out to God saying, Lord, look, don't let this be so, you know, just don't let it be so, you know, whatever, I'll do whatever you want me to do. Just something's got to not be, this isn't right. And I got to the house. My husband was there. And my brothers, my dad, and I went to my husband and I was bawling and I just said, Steve, you know, this is what we're taught, you know, whatever. And he said, Kim, that's not from the Bible. You know, that's not from any book that, you know, of wisdom, that isn't, that's something that the church made up because, also said that martyrs immediately went to heaven and skipped purgatory that the Catholic Church believes in. And so with that, then people were kind of throwing themselves in front of bullets, basically to look like they were dying as martyrs. So they'd go straight to heaven. So the church had to kind of put the hammer down and say, oh no, because it's suicide. You're not getting in. And so, so as soon as he said that, that was a relief to me. I just was praying, Lord, just give us a sign. My dad was, I've never seen grief like the level of grief that my dad suffered. He just was out of control. Like he didn't know what to do. He'd stand up and he'd fall down. And he went running out into the field at one point in time, just went running, trying to run away from it, I guess. Just, he didn't know what to do. And at one point in time, I was sitting on the ground by him. He was sitting in a chair and I was over by him. And he said, we need a sign that she didn't mean to do this. And I just started praying, Lord, show us that she didn't really mean to do this. Just show us that she didn't really mean to do this. You know, that this isn't what she meant to do. And just then one of my brothers walked in and said, where are the car keys? Because she was in the garage in her cute little white Mustang convertible. And nobody knew where the keys were. And he went back out and they were in her hand. And so she must have decided not to and turned off the car and just thought she'd sleep, I guess, in the car. Because that's, you know, what it will do to you is just make you so tired. You just want to fall asleep. And that was a huge moment. As funny as that might sound to people, for my family, that was a big moment. Like, oh, you know, she was in this dark place for a minute, but she decided not to go through with it. You know, she decided not to do it. And that gave us comfort somehow in a weird way. And but I didn't even know, like, and it was long enough ago. It was 1990. And there was such a stigma. There's still such a stigma, right? With any kind of mental illness, with suicide, there's a stigma. And we didn't know what to tell people. We were like, God, do we say how she died? Like, somehow we felt like that was a reflection on our family. And that wasn't, that didn't define our family. And we had a lot of critical people in the family. Extended family, aunts, uncles, cousins who kind of just drifted away from us, unfortunately. And you find out who's really there for you when you go through something like that. But I was just in a cloud for a while. It took me a while to really come out of that to think clearly again.
Wow. Yeah. I know you've talked about this, and I could see your face and the emotions that are still there within that. And as you were telling your story, I remember that January 31st, which was yesterday, my mom had passed. And we had this similar conversation about suicide and because she was dialysis and she went into a coma and she got it, all kinds of stuff happened to her. And she decided that she wanted to, she was tired. And I remember coming and visiting her and having this conversation. I said to her, there is no such thing in the Bible about what you're talking about. So I don't understand why you would want to burden yourself with that unbiblical belief system, because it is not, it is the traditions of men. And so I think she came to grips with it and released it. And but yeah, yesterday was my my mom's, a couple of years ago, she just passed. So you just remember. And we just lost my dad the end of last year as well, in December. So it's been, yesterday was a wonderful day of remembrance for me. You mentioned about the children having you know, how many children had it? You were talking about seizures. Because I had one with my son.
Mm. Yeah, my oldest biological child, so I have four biological children, and then we adopted a boy from the Dominican Republic, but he was older when he came into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my daughter was 3.5, she had her first seizure. And they thought it was just a febrile seizure. You know, when we took her to the hospital, we didn't know what was going on. But then a year later, when she was 4.5, she had a seizure that lasted 3.5 hours. And they told us that she likely would never walk or talk again because it was so long. And I wasn't with her. She was with a babysitter. And so by the time the babysitter let us know that she had been seizing for so long, my husband was in a different vehicle, ran home and got her, took her to the hospital. I met them at the hospital, and I walked in, and it was like a spider web of tubes all over, and my poor little 4.5-year-old baby just laying there in her panties and with all this stuff and just completely out of it. And it was horrifying. It was so hard, and we had no idea what was going on, no idea. And she was put into ICU, and I was 8 months pregnant for number 4 at the time.
Wow.
And that night, a neurologist came and told us that she had epilepsy, which was a foreign word to me. But all it really means is that you have seizures, but it doesn't tell you why. It's just the overall term, as you know, because you have a child. And I spent the night sitting in a chair next to her bed and praying and praying and praying. And she woke up the next morning and she said, "Mom," and I just cried and cried and cried. And it took her a bit before she could walk again. Mm-hmm. But she got the skills back, and she ended up being an all-state volleyball player for all 4 years of her high school years. She played volleyball in college.
Wow.
She's awesome. A wonderful mom now, two beautiful daughters, and she's come a long way. But then my number 3, when he was 3.5, he had his first seizure. So then the two of them, and his first seizure was like hers all over again. Like you would think that maybe it'd be easier to have a second child, like you've already been through it, but it wasn't. It was, if anything, harder to think that this could happen to another one of my kids. And so it was awful, but there was a complete miracle that happened in their lives. And I prayed and prayed, Lord, you know, heal them like you did back mm-hmm. in the Bible days, you know, take their seizures away, but please write it on the wall so I know that they've had their last seizure. You know, I need some evidence mm-hmm. that this is it. This is yeah. it. And that is exactly what happened. And no more seizures. After a certain day, my daughter was 9 years old and my son would have been six, and no more seizures after that. Just none. Just it was a miracle. Wow. Yeah, it was wonderful. But
powerful story of faith and belief. Having your conversation with your God, and I tell people there's nothing like it on this planet to have that conversation with your God, even when times are difficult. The Bible tells us that he's there, especially in those times. And my son, he had it when he was born. He was a young baby, and I would hold him. He was a premature baby. And I would hold him in my hands, and I would see his chest, this little baby's chest, premature baby's chest, just bouncing back and forth, can't breathe, and in this state. And the medication that we would give him would, I mean, you would, to see what it would do to this little frame, it was heart-wrenching. And at the time, I had a friend of mine that was a chiropractor, that he was a chiropractor and a trainer to lots of the Olympians and so forth. And he was my chiropractor. And I went to him and I was rehearsing my pain to him. And he told me to bring my son to him, that he would be able to adjust him using me, and which he did. And I remember when I got there, I came home and I had the medication, and I went before God and I said, you said in your word that all good things mm-hmm. come from God, and this child is a good thing. And I'm going to trust that you are faithful to your word. And I went with a bunch of Bible verses to him, Kim, and then I tossed the medication away and I kept quiet, because I know everyone else would have told me that I'm trying to kill my son. But the beautiful thing about it, his pediatricians, the doctors, everything that every time we took that child to them, they called him the textbook baby. Whatever the textbook said that he ought to be, from weight to height to everything, he was exactly what the textbook said that he needed to be. And so they called him the textbook baby. That child is 6'2". He's a tall guy. He is traveling the world all over the place, and he is perfect speaking and all of those things. So I believe in miracles just like you do, and we saw them in our lives personally. So mm-hmm. you have a powerful story. There's so much about you. The deepness of who you are as a person, as a spiritual being, is wonderful. And I want to tap into some of that. I want you to talk to us about some of those dark places that you are at emotionally. How did you manage it? Because I know there's lots of people that are listening today that maybe you have a situation in your family. Kim mentioned suicide. She mentioned medical things. And yet she is here talking about her journey. There's a way out. And I want her to recollect on some of those dark places, those belief system that you had to break free from, those fears. Talk about some of those and how you got out.
Yeah. You know, there was a time, Ken, that I thought, man, my life could be a reality TV show. Because it's like one thing would happen, another thing would happen, another thing would happen. And even today, I think, it could be. And then I think, oh, no, I've been through the worst of it. What else can possibly happen? And then something else happens. And I go, no, yeah, we could make some money this way. But, I think everybody kind of has those people in their life that it seems like everything is dumped on them, right? Like, mm-hmm. God, you know, they just have the worst luck, you know, people will say, or whatever. Yeah, yeah. But one thing that I learned through the dark times is that, for one thing, the light never goes away. Mm-hmm. So you can feel like you're in the darkest place, that where there's nothing, absolutely nothing around, but the light is there. And and there's a tomorrow. And hanging on to that and knowing that the wound heals. You don't forget, right? We don't forget things, but the wound does heal. And when it's open and festering, it's a hard time, but it does heal. And like when I was diagnosed with breast cancer a few years back, and when I was, people would say to me, "Hi, why you? You know, here you take all these medical groups on mission trips, and you help out in the third world, and you do all this work, and you do this and you do that, you know, whatever, everybody does their thing, right? Why you?" And my response was, "Well, why not me? Why would I be immune? You know, what has anybody done to be immune to any of it? I mean, we're not immune. None of us. Like, anything could happen at any time." Yeah. And so I think that the thing that separates us is our response to what happens. And there's the mountaintops and there's the valleys. And the mountaintops wouldn't be mountaintops without valleys. And, you know, if we all just lived on this straight line all the time, there would be no growth. We'd be pretty shallow human beings.
Yep.
And so
that's sad.
Yeah. So it's okay to be in the darkness. Nobody wants to be, you know, nobody wants to be there. And you sure don't want to stay there. But you were talking about losing your dad. I lost my dad a few years ago. And we were really close, really close. And he was diagnosed with mesothelioma. He was in the Navy and slept under asbestos on his ship. Oh. And it was sort of inevitable that he would get mesothelioma. And it was only 6 weeks from the time he was diagnosed to the time he passed away. And he was in his 80s, but he was like a 40-year-old man. He was, you know, working hard every day and doing his thing and fixing anything that needed to be fixed. And, you know, there for my kids and there for me, anything we needed at any time. And, you know, just the greatest guy. And so to see him go from this strong man, this dad, you know, that you look up to this man who I ended up taking care of for 6 weeks and helping him get up in the night to go to the bathroom or bringing food to him, you know, just the, such a reversal of roles and so hard to watch, you know, my dad in pain and suffering. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. Like I couldn't breathe. I felt like I couldn't breathe after he died. Like I thought, how am I ever going to be alive again? How am I ever going to feel useful again? Like I felt like I couldn't do anything. I had no memory. Like I would go into a room and, you know, I'm old enough that I do that sometimes anyway, go into a room and forget why I walked in. but more so then it was like amplified, you know, and, or pick up the phone to call somebody and then think, who was I going to call and what was I going to do? I mean, I believe though that it's the grace of God and God, no matter what you call God, spirit, the universe, there's lots of words, lots of terms, everybody, whatever, but it's, I call him God, you know, I believe in God and I, a higher power, a higher being. And I just believe that the grace of God comes over us at times like that, because it's a big thing to digest in a day. And so instead it's sort of spoon fed and little by little by little, you walk the path one step at a time. And then one step at a time, you come out on the other side.
On the other side. Yeah.
Yeah.
I call him Father.
Father.
You know,
yeah.
I have this conversation with him all the time. I think your range by which he is able to use you is vast. You have the situation where he can use you in the space of a suicide, also with children and health issues. As far as someone that is a caregiver, you have experienced that. You have experienced cancer survivor. You've experienced much, and I believe that that gives you a wider range by which he can, because of all the needs that are out there, Kim, there's quite a few that you are perfectly suited and have the faith, as I mentioned before, to speak personally to, that you can empathize with that person. You can feel their pain. You can understand exactly how they are, and you can walk with them and help them to proceed out of it. And so I look at a woman that is, her skill set is vast when it comes to helping the needs of others. And so I tip my hat off to you that you are a fighter, one that believes in her God, and that she sees the other side of it, and she understands the power of her decisions. And I love having this conversation. I really do. This is good stuff.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, we all have our stuff, right? We all go through whatever it is that we go through in life. And so I think everybody, if you really think about your life, you can think of ways that you can help other people walking through the same thing. You know, it might not be cancer, and it might not be suicide. It might not be, you know, epilepsy, but, you know, it could be relationship issues, or a rebellious child, or, you know, whatever. Like, we've all been through something in life. And I think the more you use it, the more you heal as well.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't mind getting those phone calls. I feel bad for people who are going through some of the things, but I sure want to be there for them.
I'm glad that you are there, because you can really hold their hands with that conversation when you're having with them. Mine, I remember one of my things is we spoke earlier about kids having five boys, and I cannot tell you the amount of families that have come to me and prayed, asked me to pray for them that that couldn't have kids, and they wanted me to lay hands on them and pray. And I would lay hands and pray, Kim, and every single one of them had boys.
So if anybody wanted a girl, they knew not to go to you.
not to come to me. And so why? Because I had the faith for it. I had five boys. And so in my mind, when I'm praying for that family, I am praying with that energy for boys, because I'm familiar with that. So I'm able to be used in that fashion. So I would tell women, just make sure you want a boy before you come and ask me to pray for you. Because so here you are, Kim, all of this stuff. I know you had talked about the reality show, but the reality show didn't come forward. Books did. How did the process for the first book, how did that manifest?
Well, when I got the phone call at 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon telling me that the biopsy came back positive and I had breast cancer, after, you know, calling my husband crying and whatever, by the way, my husband was at work, I was at home. And, when I called him, I could barely get words out to tell him about the phone call I'd received. And it seemed like minutes later he was there, and he walked in and he just grabbed me and held me. And that was,
sounded like a wonderful gentleman.
He was an incredible man, but just so everybody knows, that was exactly the right thing to do. Just hold on. But so the next day though, I went to the bookstore because I wanted to know what I was going through. And everything was either very medical or depressing. And I thought, mm-hmm. wow, I just want to know, what's it feel like? Like, are there decisions to be made? You know, what am I going to go through? You know, that's what I wanted to know. And so mm-hmm. I started writing really as a way to keep friends and family up to date. I'm going to the doctor tomorrow. I've got surgery scheduled for, you know, or whatever. But it mm-hmm. turned into much more than just I'm going to the doctor. And before I knew it, 5,000 people were reading my emails, it was at the time, that I was sending out. And so I continued to write. 4 months after I was diagnosed, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and died 6 weeks later. So I was writing during all of that time. And then I put my everything on hold when my husband was diagnosed and then had surgeries and things to go through after he passed away. And so I continued to write for about a year. And that all those writings turned into a book, Cry Until You Laugh. And I named it Cry Until You Laugh because I think that's what you have to do. You know, of mm-hmm. course you're going to mourn and of course you're going to cry. And of course there's going to be tears. There's going to be sadness. I mean, those are just real things that you're not going to avoid, right? I mean, we're human. Yeah. But you have to be able to laugh again. You have to give yourself permission, I learned. You have to really give yourself permission to laugh again. You know, that it's not dishonoring to anyone who has passed away. I would do anything in the world to have my husband back. If he walked through the door right now, I'd be so happy. Like, that would be the greatest thing. Yeah. But it's not going to happen. And so, you know, I have to be able to laugh again. And I know people who have struggled laughing again because mm-hmm. they feel like it's disrespectful. You know, like, oh, I should be in mourning because my husband passed away, my child passed away, you know, my father, my mother. Yeah. But don't live in it. You know, don't live in it. Yeah. Live in joy. Live in joy. Joy is a gift from God, too. And accept it. Accept that gift. And it's okay to laugh. And they would want you to, by the way, you know, mm-hmm. so it's okay to laugh. It's okay to do. So anyway, so that's my first book. So the process there was way different than my second book because I was writing just, you know, once a week or kind of when I felt like it, felt like I had something to say. That's when I wrote. And so I talked about the realness of dealing with breast cancer and there are decisions to be made. Like, I had to make a decision. I had to have a mastectomy and I could have one side or both. And we were sitting mm-hmm. around the dining room table and I said, gosh, how do I make this decision? I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I don't have enough information to know what I'm doing. And one of my sons said, Mom, would you put new siding on just half the house? And I went, oh, good answer, son. There you go. Now I have the answer. So, you know, I mean, you go through it all together, right? So, So that was my first.
That's powerful book. That you have your family there that are walking with you as well. Your husband, and he also, from listening to you, sounded like a tremendous individual. A warrior in his own rights. And you had your situation and his simultaneously. That is some, I don't even know how to describe that. And I have conversations with people several a day about their journey. I have not met one, Kim, that is like you. And so I am trying to see how to formulate this question because to be in that place, I don't even know what to say because you're dealing with yours. You're dealing with the news of your husband and you are managing how to live. And I understand you're also just making your notes to your book, which eventually became your book. But how did you navigate that world? My Lord.
Oh my. Yeah. There were some tough times in there. There's no doubt about it. My husband had been having stomach issues and went to the doctor and the doctor said, oh, it's because your wife has cancer. You know, it's just nerves, just take some Rolaids. And Then went a couple months later, same thing. And then went to a gastro specialist and same thing. And I had had surgery. And so I was in bed and still healing. And he, when I woke up in the morning, he was awake. And he said that his stomach pain was just so bad. I said, that's it. You know, doctors aren't doing anything. Go to the ER. They'll run a test. They'll do something. They'll do something for you. Yeah. They're not going to just let you go. And so he drove himself to the emergency room. And he was a rule follower. And so he had his cell phone off. And as I'm trying to call him to see what's going on. And finally, I got a phone call. And he said, I guess they're going to keep me overnight. I'm thinking, they don't ever keep anybody overnight. What do you mean they're going to keep you overnight? Like, what is that about? So I got in real people clothes for the first time since surgery. And I ran out the door. I drove like a mad woman on Vicodin, you know, through the streets. And I was almost to the hospital and got another phone call. And he said, well, I guess there's a mass on my liver. Gosh. And I just started bawling. And I got to the hospital and I don't really even remember parking. I remember running in, holding all parts of my body from the surgery. Were in pain.
From the surgery. Yeah.
And I go running in and they told me where he was and it was behind a curtain and I whipped open the curtain and he's just sitting on the edge of the bed like nothing's going on. And I'm sobbing. And he said, listen, I am not going to invite you out anymore if this is the way you're going to behave. And I said, listen, buddy, you don't get to be funny right now. This is not funny time. But it took a few days for the diagnosis to come in. They knew that it was cancer. They didn't know what kind of cancer. They thought colon and whatever. In the end, it ended up, it was either bile duct or pancreatic cancer. There was a scope that they could have done to determine exactly, but why go through it? It's the same prognosis.
Yeah.
And pancreatic cancer just is one of those that, you know, isn't good. And so, but they thought he'd have a year or so. He was a healthy guy and, you know, young and healthy. And so we had a great time together. We watched Cash Cab every day and watched some sports and played some cards and just hung out together. And thinking that he's going to have this time, made some plans, you know, to travel a little bit, maybe, and whatever. Yeah, and and then, well, we prayed from the minute he was diagnosed. Our prayer was, Lord, heal him like you did the blind and the lame and the deaf, you know, heal him like you did, or the ultimate healing of heaven, but please don't let him suffer. And God answered that prayer. It was unbelievable. I see what other people go through. And we did not go through that. We had great hospice care, but my husband was not in pain until the very, very end, the last couple hours of his life. And, but he was fine up walking around eating, you know, everything's just fine. And then all of a sudden, you know, just got more painful and he was sitting on the edge of the bed and he just was so uncomfortable. And I was behind him, hanging on to him, so he wouldn't fall off the bed, and just holding him as tight as I could. And he was miserable at that moment. And I just said, baby, go, just go. And he did.
Wow.
And that was it.
Wow.
And it was such an answer to prayer because he didn't suffer. You know, he didn't linger. You know, a lot of people, you know, even the last month or so are in a hospital bed or in a hospital even. And he was at home the whole time. We were together the whole time. And, you know, a lot of interesting things happened during that time. It was like there was a transition to death. It wasn't like this moment, even though it ended up being, you know, there was a moment when he stopped breathing completely. But there were times before that that I would look into his eyes and see that he wasn't really there and wonder where he was. And he just kind of made this smooth transition. And he was just a faithful man. He chased God. Like he didn't ebb and flow, you know, like he just chased God his whole life. And 5 o'clock every morning was on his face before God and praying and reading the Bible and a devotional book. And he was just a great guy. And so I've never begrudged him. Like, I've never thought, oh, woe is me or whatever. I've always thought, good for you, baby. Good for you. You ran the race. You finished it. You did it right. And, you know, to go to heaven, he was 51. I was 47. And to go to heaven at 51 and not pay any more bills, no more illness, you know, no more of the stuff that we have to deal with, right? No COVID. He never had to live through a pandemic, you know, whatever. And so good for him. Good for him.
That is so funny. You're funny in the midst of all of this. But listening to your story, what a privilege and an honor that both of you had walking through that journey until the time that he decided to leave the planet. And in many cases, in some cases, people have that choice, and it's good that he had that, and you were there to give him permission to make his decision to go on to the next dimension, as we say. And he's just exiting the body, and the body is here, but he is alive, probably having a conversation with his God that he was reading about in the morning and talking to. So that's a beautiful picture that you have given to us. So here you are, this woman that has such a vast resume of life experience. Your second book, how did that title came in and you just got published? How did that come out? And how do you feel about that?
Well, the title of the book is Love Is. After losing my husband, who I was madly in love with, I just questioned love. And, you know, I thought about it and I thought, hey, do I really understand it? Do I really know the true meaning? And there's not a manual. You know, you don't go to the bookstore and find, you know, Love for Dummies or something, right? Mm-hmm. We learn from our parents. We learn from people around us. And not everything that we're taught about love is love. Not everything done in the name of love is love. And so I thought, well, gosh, you know, God is love. John, in the Bible, John says that God is love. Not that God loves, not that God is loving, but that God is love. So love is beyond an emotion, right? Like fear, you know, you're not fear. Mm-hmm. You have fear. You're not fear. Yeah. But God is love. And so if God is love, can't we be love then too? And but what does it mean? What would that even look like? And so I decided I would dedicate a full year to figure out the real meaning of love. And I took that beautiful 2,000-year-old poem that we hear at a lot of weddings, love is patient, love is kind, does not envy, does not boast, etc.
Corinthians, the book of Corinthians.
Right. My plan was to take one word a month and figure out, well, what is love that is patient? What does that mean? What is love that is kind? And there are 14 words. And so the math didn't quite work out. It took me longer than a year. But it was quite a journey, and every single one was different than what I expected. Every single one. And most of the time I was in Haiti when I was working on it, when I was, you know, just working on it, you know, figuring it out. And so I start each chapter with what I think it is. And then the story that happens that brings me to the realization of what it really is. Because I figured out that if you put love is or love is not in front of any word, it completely changes the meaning. So I was chased by motorcycle gangs. I got lost on a mile-high mountain with a medical student, a sweet, sweet medical student. I had to sleep outside with snakes and tarantulas. And I had some crazy experiences that brought me to realizations and changed my life. I think would change anybody's life, knowing that, first of all, we can be love and that we can live love and we can understand love. And so Love is the name of the book. And so that was a whole different journey than my first book, for sure.
Yeah, that sounds like a powerful book. I actually was listening to some of your stories in along with the Haiti trip. And for those who are listening to this podcast, I want you to pay attention to this to Kim, one of the most powerful people I've ever met in my life. And her journey, as I've said before, her resume is vast. The study of love is something else. And I listened to that podcast that you had and your journey as to how that came about. Once you have made a decision about love and studying love for a year, there's no way that you're not going to be given situations that will come up into your life that will afford you opportunity to make other decisions than what you are studying. So I implore everyone that is listening to this, buy this book, buy her books. And if you want to learn about love, because Kim and I said earlier that this is what this world needs, couples needs this, because you need to experience what love is. She talked about the relationship with her husband and herself. And you and I need to learn deeper from her. The Bible says they came to Jesus and said, what's the greatest commandment on, you know? And he said, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy mind, with all thy strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And it sounded, Kim, like you went on this journey and you got to know this God of love. As you mentioned, God is love. And from that relationship, you're able to extrapolate your lessons learned and delivered it to us in the pages of this book. And so I challenge everyone to get a copy of it so that you can learn about what she has been through. Tell me, I don't even know where to go with this because you have deposited so much. You have been through so much. Talk to me about today, the woman that is before me. What's there for you now?
I'm excited for the future. Things are great. I actually just bought a house. I've been living in I moved from the house I was with my husband in to a little condo downtown in my city. And now I'm going back out to a house where I can have my grandkids over more and closer to them. And I'm excited about that. But I'm excited about life in general. You know, I don't know what's going to come my way exactly, but I'm very passionate about my book. I'm passionate about the things that I learned. I really believe that the world would be a whole different place if we all knew how to love each other. And I believe that Republicans and Democrats can sit down in a room together and get along and can love each other, and vaxxers and anti-vaxxers, and it's okay. And that, you know, the lines that are on a map are lines that we have drawn. God didn't draw any lines on a map. And so some of the issues that are out there, so much of it can be handled when you understand love and you understand that we are supposed to love each other. And and it is the greatest freedom to know that that's all you have to do is love.
Yeah.
So there's no judgment, no condemnation, no boasting, I'm smarter, I'm better, I'm greater. No, we're all walking on the same dirt. We're all at the same level. And love recognizes that. So with love, there's complete equality. And there is just this beautiful, total freedom that you can live in when you understand love.
I agree with you. It is the one ingredient. If the world, as you said, would utilize it, it will change humanity forever. And I think because of fearful thinking and belief system, many are not willing to experience what that is about. And they cling to their fearfulness because it is how the politicians get elected. They spew a fear driven concept or reality, and it causes people to respond, which in most cases it's not true. So, but it's just what they do in order to get there. Kim, I want to thank you so much. I am so I'm sweating from all the stuff. I'm telling you, I am like, this has been one of the deepest, most powerful conversations I've ever had in my life. And I have been having conversations with people for a mighty long time. And so I want to thank you so much for coming and entrusting us with who you are today. And I am asking all those that are listening to get in touch with her, follow her so that she can help you get her books, utilize those principles. She talks about love, utilize the principles of love. She talks about her dark places with cancer. I mean, she also is talking about her relationship with her God. And so I implore you guys to get your relationship with your God in check, because it has supported her through every single thing that she's been through. Everything she has ever said was based on that relationship. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken, so much. I've enjoyed the conversation for sure. I feel like I could just talk to you for hours and hours and hours.
I thank you so much.
Everyone who's listening to this podcast, we hope to continually help you to learn how to embrace moments of darkness, because it is in the darkness that we learn how to develop and use our abilities to truly see those parts of ourselves, often invisible to us, in the light. It becomes your responsibility to navigate through all of your trials to find out who you truly are and begin your journey to loving yourself, which is possibly one of the most difficult things you will ever do in your life. To love yourself and to find the real you. But always remember to enjoy the journey. Thank you for coming by. Please subscribe. And if you can support us financially, we deeply appreciate it. You can do this by hitting the heart button. Until next time, invite your family, friends, neighbors, anyone that you can. You can hear us on Buzzsprout, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Music, iHeartRadio, CastBox, Overcast, and many more.